It's just past 7:08 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Starting with Iran this morning, the latest escalation is the U.S. has issued new sanctions against several figures in the Iranian government. And the president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, has in response called Donald Trump a retard. That is the state of international affairs today. I want to dig deeper on the developments of last week's rather dramatic walk back of a planned U.S. strike on Iran on Thursday. You will recall that the United States had been planning to launch an airstrike. Reportedly, President Trump called that off about 10 minutes before it would have been irreversible, but a parallel cyber attack did take place. That was reported by AP early yesterday. The cyber attack targeting several pieces of air defense hardware in Iran raises all kinds of questions, one of which is that an act of war? We're joined now by one of the experts on this front. John Bateman is a fellow in the Cyber Policy Initiative of the Technology and International Affairs Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and comes to this from a long background in the U.S. government, principally military strategy and intelligence. John Bateman, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
I want to start by kind of situating you for our listeners, because I think you have a somewhat different career trajectory from the bulk of the experts that we bring on. You were involved in setting up the current cyber command in the U.S. government?
That's right. Yeah, I was an intelligence officer focused on cyber issues in the Department of Defense, and I worked on policy and the cyber realm as well. And so Cyber Command has had a years-long history in various stages of maturation as a military command. And I was involved a few years ago in the effort to stand it up to be on the level of the other combatant commands like Central Command and Strategic Command that the military has.
And why did you bail out of government service and go into think tank land?
Well, it was mostly for personal reasons. I'd been in the government for a number of years, and I was looking for something different. And actually, this week's events with Iran has reminded me of how, if you're still in government nowadays, you're really dealing with the crisis of the day, the crisis of the week. The great thing about being in a think tank is you can take a step back and think about the strategic context for it all.
You were, within the U.S. government, a senior expert on Iranian cyber forces. So I'd like to get your take on what happened last Thursday. To my mind, the news that President Trump had abruptly called off a military strike, and then the news a few days later that a cyber strike had happened at the same time, suggested maybe he wasn't in a position to call off that one. Do you have the same read?
Well, one way to read the cyber strike is that the U.S. government and President Trump decided they had other means of imposing costs on Iran's recent actions in shooting down the UAV and attacking and sabotaging shipping in the country. A cyber attack arguably was a proportional and smart way to de-escalate the immediate crisis because it hits the capabilities that Iran was using in its attacks. So these cyber attacks were reportedly targeting Iranian air defense systems and intelligence systems that Iran was using in the Gulf. And it imposes some meaningful cost for Iran's actions and allows the president to say that he did something. On the other hand, this kind of cyber attack is typically reversible, so Iran will be able to clean up the damage overall, and there weren't any casualties or visible damage, so it's unlikely to precipitate a further cycle of retaliation and escalation. And that's kind of the sweet spot that you would look for in this type of situation, to impose costs without getting into a further escalatory spiral.
You said it would let the president say he did something, but he did not, in fact, come out and say he did something. The Associated Press, citing anonymous sources inside the administration, said it happened several days after the fact.
That's right, and that's typical in the cyber realm. A lot of these operations are cloak and dagger and kept under wraps, and the government very rarely openly acknowledges cyber operations. But often what will happen is that it will allow it to come out through the press. And this creates some realm of plausible deniability, but it's likely in this case that it was senior administration officials authorized to put out this story in order to make it be known that the U.S. didn't just take this incident lying down.
So then I want to ask you to go back to the New York Times article that came out on June 15th. This is a pretty sweeping overview of both the consolidation of U.S. cyber command and specifically operations against Russia, efforts to implant malicious code in Russia's cyber infrastructure, and actual attacks on power infrastructure as well. One of the parts of that article that leapt out at me was buried deep in it, in which they said, based on two anonymous sources, that people involved in cyber attacks in the U.S. military are doing their best to not brief President Trump when it comes to Russia and have the authority to launch attacks without direct presidential approval. Is this a big change from when you were in government service?
Well, there are a couple big trends converging here. Under the Obama administration, cyber operations were kept under a pretty tight leash by the White House. And President Obama and the National Security Council was intensely engaged in allowing or disallowing cyber operations, thinking about the political consequences, the legal consequences. And most experts actually believe they went a little bit too far there. And so when the Trump administration came in, as part of a broader effort to unleash the military, as President Trump said, there were new authorities put in place where the Defense Department could take greater action in cyberspace without necessarily briefing or getting specific authorization from the president. But in practice, in my experience, a significant cyber operation like the one that was announced against Iran would still be brought to the president, even if it may or may not have specifically required that approval. If you're the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, this is the kind of thing that you want to get top cover on.
Now, I gather that cyber operations, because they don't involve, you know, physical violations of land or airspace, fall into kind of a gray area of international law when it comes to the law of war. But disabling another country's hardware, especially its military hardware, it is an escalation. At what point does this get considered an act of war?
Well, on this specific event, it's important to put it in context. This cyber operation against Iranian military assets came after Iran had admitted to shooting down a U.S. military asset, the drone that was flying over the Strait of Hormuz. So,
well,
if you think about
it, it was in Iranian airspace.
And, you know, I don't have specific knowledge of that. I will just say that in general, the U.S. government, even under the Trump administration, has some greater credibility than Iran on this issue. So I guess we really don't know, and you kind of have to pick which side you believe. But ultimately, the use of a cyber operation to respond to a physical assault, you could argue, is a step back. Now, to your broader question about international law and what counts as an act of war in cyberspace, unfortunately, there aren't clear answers on that. There are no treaties or international law that specifically cover cyber attacks. Instead, there's an informal consensus that the broad body of general international law applies to cyberspace. For example, the requirement that countries respect one another's sovereignty. But there's very little agreement about how international law applies to cyber attacks in these types of situations.
So what do Iran's preparations look like? This isn't their first tango. The U.S. used a virus called Stuxnet to permanently disable a large amount of hardware that Iran was using for uranium enrichment before the nuclear deal was struck.
So the Stuxnet attack on Iran was a wake-up call for that country, because this was a period of time where it still wasn't clear what kind of power cyber could have in a strategic dynamic. And after 2010, when Stuxnet was discovered, Iran started to develop its own cyber capabilities. And there was a period between 2010 and 2012 under the Obama administration where the U.S. and Iran were really in an escalating covert war that included cyber, economic, and physical dimensions, with the U.S. imposing stronger sanctions, Iran hitting back with cyber attacks, and even at one point attempting to assassinate the Saudi ambassador inside Washington, D.C. That ended up culminating in the nuclear deal. And in some ways, we're kind of a return now to that period of tension between the U.S. and Iran. But it's much less auspicious that it'll come to a peaceful result this time.
I guess the question from my layman's point of view is, why doesn't the principle of once bitten, twice shy hold? Can't they just unplug the hardware so it can't be hacked?
An option that you have is always to what's called reduce the attack surface. So that could be unplugging something from the internet or imposing other types of cybersecurity metrics. Probably Iran is doing all it can in that realm already, but you can't really unplug an air defense system. You still need it to connect to other pieces of military hardware, like your radar, your command and control systems, your intelligence capabilities. So at the end of the day, for a sophisticated power like the United States, there may still be a way to get back in. I will say on that front, it was a significant decision for the U.S. to use this cyber capability here because these aren't so easily acquired. The U.S. would have had to have penetrated this network and develop an implant and an access that it could use. And this might have taken years to develop, given that a foreign military weapon system is one of the most prized and complicated targets in cyberspace. So for the U.S. to decide to use this capability to shut down the Iranian systems now, rather than save it for another kind of contingency, would have been a hard decision.
In other words, you only get to use it once. Using it as a warning is pretty significant if you might need it later for actual combat.
That's right. Once the capability is used and it's announced, Iran has the opportunity to research those systems, detect whatever implant was there and remove it, and then even remedy the vulnerabilities that were exploited in the first place. So there is a kind of you use it, you lose it dynamic here, and the U.S. will probably have to reset its ability to penetrate these weapon systems.
So I want to recap what I am surmising is your take on the cyber attack on Thursday. Is the U.S. did it as a warning. The warning was amplified by leaks to the press, or I guess anonymous statements to the press saying, yeah, that's what we did. And then ask you to kind of apply that same logic to the article that came out June 15th, scoping U.S. cyber operations against Russia. Do you see that as an outgrowth of the same intentional process of leaking, of signaling what U.S. capabilities are publicly?
Without knowing for sure, it's probable that that's the case. And again, I would contrast to the Obama administration and the Stuxnet attack. That attack was highly secretive. And in fact, when it was eventually leaked that the U.S. government was behind this, there was a massive investigation inside the U.S. government to determine who leaked it and potentially prosecute them. Now you don't hear much about that, and it seems like there's an effort by the National Security Council or others to put out these types of messages as a way of deterring and warning Russia in this case, that if they were to take action against our, let's say, electrical grid, we might have capabilities to do the same thing to them. So it's a form of signaling and deterrence.
Why deter with cyber versus cyber? Like, why is the threat of hacking and disabling another country's systems a more effective threat than economic sanctions or military countermeasures?
Well, that's a great question. And overall, most people believe, and the U.S. government has said, that you don't have to respond in kind. So, for example, just because we might be attacked by a cyber attack, that doesn't mean we have to respond with a cyber attack. We could use sanctions or military tools. But the fact is, each tool comes with its own strengths and weaknesses. The benefits of cyber attacks are that they're global in reach, they're covert, so you can control what's known about them. They're relatively cheap and low risk compared to military tools. And with sanctions, to some extent, the U.S. is tapped out. We've imposed most of the sanctions that we could impose against a country like Iran. And Russia also is under significant sanctions. And to ratchet that up further might actually create problems for the United States.
When you say cyber attacks are low risk, you mean the U.S. is not putting any of its troops in the firing line in order to carry them out? I mean, an attack that took down another country's power grid could cost a lot of lives.
Well, it would be a very serious act. And as I understand, the signaling from the U.S. government is that this is a deterrent capability. This is something that would only be unleashed in the event that that Russia were to do something similar against the U.S. networks. So there's a fear that if you don't have that kind of deterrence, you leave yourself open and vulnerable for attacks from Russia. And it's important in this context to point out, Russia is actually understood to have taken out the portion of the power grid in Ukraine for a period of time several years ago in the context of Russia's armed activities in that country.
Speaking of John Bateman, he's a fellow in the Cyber Policy Initiative of the Technology and International Affairs Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Prior to that, he had a career of government service, Trained as an intelligence analyst, he served as director for cyber strategy implementation in the office of the U.S. Secretary of Defense, and trying to get a window into what is only recently being reported through anonymous sources, which is the growing U.S. military capability to strike through the web, or at least in the cyberspace. Some of the viruses being distributed are likely moving physically, not over any network connection. John Bateman, I want to talk a little bit about kind of the command and control side of this. You worked on developing these military capabilities, cyber military capabilities for the U.S. government at the highest level of government, at the president level. Are the civilian people who are supposed to be in charge of the military, do they even really understand what the military's capabilities are, or what it's doing when it infiltrates and implants code?
You know, cyber capabilities are notoriously technical and complex. And so there is an understood problem in how do you communicate the kind of complex information about how a cyber attack functions, collateral damage, risk assessments to political leadership, whether it's President Trump or President Obama or another president who may not have that kind of technical savvy. What I will say is that the U.S. government has probably built up some muscle memory in this over the years. And you can break things down in simple ways and just describe the effects that you'd like to achieve. But there's always a risk of miscommunicating. And for example, in the Stuxnet attack that we've been talking about, that was intended to be restricted just to the Iranian nuclear system and never to spread beyond that. It didn't quite work out that way. And the Stuxnet virus did actually spread to other systems and other countries. And that's how it was ultimately discovered. So there are risks of miscommunication and miscalculation.
Which raises a bigger question, which is for these cyber incursions to be an effective deterrent, the U.S. Cyber Command has to start infiltrating and implanting code in other countries' equipment years before it might be used, years before there might even be combat. That almost seems like pre-war. Like I don't know, if I were to create a in real life analog, it would be like secretly crossing the border into another country and burying explosives under their military installations.
You know, that's actually a great analogy. And, you know, in the military, the jargon, the doctrinal term is operational preparation of the environment. You worry about what we call the security dilemma, which is in order to defend your own interests, whether it's in cyberspace or elsewhere, you need to take actions that might actually be perceived as threatening by other countries and then precipitate the very crisis that you're trying to avoid. So the security dilemma in cyberspace is very intense, because you do actually need to penetrate and prepare inside the networks of other countries. And were those accesses and implants to be discovered by those victim countries, they wouldn't necessarily know whether your intent is to collect intelligence, to develop an attack that could be used later, or to conduct an imminent attack. So this is always part of the risk calculus for putting together these types of operations.
So I guess that leads me back to the question of international law. We have this highly elaborated body of international law that applies to conventional combat. It's not always observed by actual countries in the world, but it does kind of articulate the parameters of under what conditions the use of force is acceptable and against whom and with what collateral consequences. Is anybody working on determining what the guardrails should be for cyber war, for the area you worked in?
This has been an effort underway diplomatically for some years now, and much of this has happened within the United Nations. Although we don't yet have a specific treaty or international law that covers cyber attacks, the United Nations has convened what they call a group of governmental experts, basically a few dozen countries to come together and try to work towards some type of consensus. And there was initial progress a few years ago in developing some broad non-binding norms, like, for example, that countries should not disrupt each other's critical infrastructure during peacetime. But this UN process essentially collapsed in 2017 because there was just too much disagreement amongst the different parties. The U.S. wanted to continue drilling down into more specifics as to how international law would apply, whereas countries like Cuba, China, and Russia were concerned about the direction that this was going and how it might be used against their own interest. So there's some efforts underway to reboot these talks, but most people aren't very optimistic because of the broader state of geopolitical tensions in the world right now, and the fact that a lot of other international agreements, like nuclear arms control, are kind of weakening and fraying. So it's a hard time to put together a new international agreement for cyberspace.
How big a gap in capabilities is there between the United States and the rest of the world's powers?
You know, most experts tend to describe a top tier of countries, with the US, Russia, and Israel in that category, and then maybe China a little bit below. And then below that, you'd have countries like Iran and North Korea that have substantial capabilities, but not at the level of an elite program. Below that, the most recent phenomenon is more and more countries developing a credible governmental level cyber capability. Like, for example, the United Arab Emirates has been increasingly in the news for some of its cyber capabilities to surveil dissidents and pursue military activities in the Gulf region. So I think over the next few years, we're likely to see more and more countries develop a basic capability they could use to hack and disrupt networks.
All right, John Bateman, appreciate you taking the time to speak to us.
Thanks very much.
John Bateman's a fellow in the Cyber Policy Initiative of the Technology and International Affairs Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He is trained as a military intelligence analyst. His area of expertise was Iran, and previously served as director of cyber strategy implementation in the office of the U.S. Secretary of Defense. So he has been under the hood of a lot of the cyber war capabilities that we've been discussing. That takes us to 7:30 in the morning. The program's Up Front. My name is Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Coming up in the second half of this program, A Journey Underground with author Robert McFarlane, who literally spent 5 years traveling underground to document some of the world's deepest, darkest places. We'll discuss his book, Underland, A Deep Chime Journey, when we come back after the news.